Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Dan Oliver. Dan is the director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education, or CMRE for short. The CMRE is a nonprofit educational organization that seeks to promote greater public understanding of the nature of the monetary process and of the central role that a healthy monetary system plays in a well-being, indeed, the very survival of a free society. Dan is also the founder and managing director of Mermican Capital. That's a private investment company that invests in gold and gold mining shares. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for joining me again.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's really always good to talk to you. Dan, you recently headed up the CMRE Spring Dinner. It's a spring dinner meeting that the CMRE has held for many years. You had some very distinguished speakers at this last event, including the likes of Paul Volcker, John Brown, Thomas Honing, among others. Would you care to tell our listeners a little bit about what these gentlemen had to say? And also, did they give you any hope that we might actually see some improvement in monetary policy sometime in the future?
Yeah, it was a great dinner, and it was well attended, and the guests were interesting, and the presentations were great. One of the things that I started with, I gave the introduction for the evening, is I was recently rereading Paul Warburg's monographs. Now, Paul Warburg was a banker back in the early 19th century, and really considered the intellectual founder of the Federal Reserve. He wrote a series of monographs, and rereading them, it was quite extraordinary, because one of the things that he said was that it was unsound and dangerous for a bank to lend credit other than terms at which it gets credit. In other words, you go down to the bank and you deposit $100 overnight funds. You can get them back anytime you want. And then the bank takes it out and lends it to me for 30 years.
Right.
So it's lent it to me on terms different than it got it from you. And he called that unsound and dangerous. And yet this is what all commercial banks do. And until recently, the Federal Reserve really didn't do this. The Federal Reserve issued currency, which is a current asset, and it bought three-month paper from the federal government and from businesses. So, okay, it was 3 months, not overnight, but the maturity transformation wasn't that great. And
sure.
Under Bernanke, the Fed started buying 30-year bonds, right? So all of a sudden, the Fed is now doing precisely what the founder of the Fed called unscientific and dangerous. And he went further and said that notes created on the basis of government bonds were similarly dangerous, and yet this is precisely what the Federal Reserve does. So I thought it was fascinating that the guy who created the intellectual foundations would refer to the current system as dangerous. And so I asked Volcker and Honing their opinions of this, and I was very surprised by Thomas Honing, because here's a guy who was a Federal Reserve governor. He's currently vice chairman of the FDIC, so it's hard to imagine someone more involved in the system than he is. And his reaction to those comments was, well, that's why I'm trying to raise the reserve requirements of the banks, which is a half answer. I think the answer is he can't get up and say, oh, I think the fractional reserve bank system makes no sense. I mean, what would be the point of that?
Yeah.
He wouldn't change anything, and all he would do is lose his own stature. But by subtly changing the reserve requirements, he's at least heading in the right direction.
Right.
It won't solve the problem, but it'll make it less bad. What Volcker, the news item that came out of that was, of course, when he was saying in his interview that gold was the enemy when he was a Federal Reserve. Of course, gold is the ultimate current asset. It has no future cash flows the way real estate or stocks have future cash flows. Gold doesn't. And so from that perspective, it's the antithesis of other long-term assets. And what he meant was, people have interpreted that to mean that he was out there manipulating the gold price. He may or may not have been, but that's not what he was talking about. What he was talking about was that when he was there, especially, gold was the metric of how well the system was doing. In other words, when the gold price was going higher, it meant the market was rejecting the Federal Reserve system.
Right.
When it was going lower, it meant that the market was accepting it. And the way he saved the system, the way he saved the Federal Reserve, was he raised interest rates, as you know, to 21%. And what that did was it devalued all of the assets in the Federal Reserve's books, all those bonds they had. If you buy a bond when rates are 5% and the rates go to 20%, you effectively lose all your money.
Yeah.
And gold shot up to $835 an ounce. When it passed $500 an ounce, the gold on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet completely backed his liabilities. In other words, he didn't admit this, but the reality is that Volcker, through his actions, essentially returned the Federal Reserve to a gold standard. Not legally, of course, but the mm-hmm. market did it for him. And I thought that was extremely interesting. What he did say was that when he got going in the Federal Reserve and as a profession 20 years earlier, so in the 1960s, really late 50s, interest rates were very low. And throughout his career, they went higher and higher and higher until you hit 1980. And since then, they've gone lower and lower and lower. And he himself said that the environment we're in now is a brave new world, and he wasn't sure that the tools and the things that he had done were necessarily applicable to this framework. In other words, what the Federal Reserve has done is take us into uncharted territory. Now, mm-hmm. he wasn't going to criticize what's happening now, but I took that to mean that if he's nervous about that, that's not a good sign.
Right. Well, he's I guess in a sense he's a politician. And he knows, even if he's thinking, and even if he is critical of the Fed, he's not going to say it, probably.
Well, that's right. That's exactly.
So in any event, well, thanks. That's a good summary, Daniel. Thank you for that. Volcker certainly did. I mean, I put the question to Mark Faber and Ron Paul maybe 10 years ago or so at a gathering at a luncheon and a dinner that we had in San Francisco, and I asked them, do you think that that another Volcker could be pulled now to try to straighten things out again? And of course, neither of them thought anything like that would be possible. And that was well before the recent debasing of the currency and massive buildup of the Federal Reserve balance sheet. So I'd like to get you to talk a little bit about your March 16th missive that you wrote, titled "Credit Onslaught." In that article you stated that most investors really have no clue about money. Unfortunately, that seems to be the case. You suggested in the 1930s people had a better perspective of money than they do now. Why do you think that was true?
Well, if you look at the history of banking, and specifically American banking, money was defined to be a certain amount of silver. I think it was 331 grains of silver, and then as the gold standard replaced the bimetallic standard, it turned into a certain weight of gold. And you often hear, oh, well, there isn't enough gold to go around to support the currency. Well, no, it was the opposite. The currency was defined as a mass of gold, and people understood that. And what you did was you deposited your gold at a bank, and the bank gave you paper money, and the paper money is much more convenient to run around than gold coins in your pockets. I mean, if you have gold coins in your pockets, you get a hole in your pocket, that is really unhappy. But you put the paper notes in your wallet, they don't wear out. You don't lose them. It's a much. They can be a much smaller denomination. A dollar worth of gold would be so small you could barely see it. You wouldn't be able to weigh it. No one would accept it. So paper money really was a way to more conveniently move gold around. And everyone understood that. And the reason was that until Franklin Roosevelt came along, anyone could go down to the bank with their paper money and get their gold back. So everyone knew exactly the relationship between gold and money, and that was that the money stood for a certain amount of gold and they could get it back. And because of that, people had to consider, why is gold money? That was a question that was always in people's minds because it was the thing you got when you handed in your paper money. Why does anyone want that to begin with? And the answer, of course, is that gold is the most liquid item that there is in the market. It has the smallest spread between bid and ask. It has the most consistent value. Its quantity is the most constant. All these different things. It is not used in industry, which is very important. People think that's a liability. They say, well, money should be oil because we use it. And the answer is no.
No.
Because the business cycle means that when things are hot, things like oil are very valuable. And when things crash, things like oil are very cheap. Well, gold isn't used in industry. You don't build buildings with it. So it's unaffected by the business cycle, which is another reason why its value is so stable, it's so liquid. Mm-hmm. So people understood that, and they understood that when the banks failed, what that meant was that your claims on gold were defaulted upon. You went down to the bank and you said, I want my gold. The bank said, sorry, drop dead. We're not giving it to you. And so that's effectively what happened in the 30s. And so I think that's why people in the 30s really understood what money was, and especially when they couldn't get at it. And what's interesting to me now is that What banks used to do was pyramid loans on top of their gold reserve. Of course, now the Federal Reserve System, they do is they pyramid reserves on top of dollars. And so when the banking system starts faltering, what happens is there's a huge shortage of dollars because the banks have lent out a multiple of dollars as opposed to what actually people have. And so there's a huge short squeeze, and there's an enormous pressure on people to go get dollars, and the banks don't want to give it to people. That's why you see all over the world now banks and governments and complicit saying, oh, well, if you go down to the bank and you try to get out $5,000 in cash, they call the police because you must be a social agitator or a drug person or something else.
Right.
So the connection, it was before you couldn't turn your paper money in for gold. Now you can't turn your deposits in for paper money. And even Janet Yellen, I think, said, oh, well, you know, the reason why you can have negative interest rates is because having paper money is so inconvenient that people will actually pay to have it stored in the bank, which is a wonderful thing to say. But again, if you actually try to go get it, they call the police on you. So I think that it's an interesting development in banking. But of course, I think it also shows just how tremendously fragile the bank system is.
Well, the bank system is fragile, and as you're pointing out in your article, the dollar has been, the gold has really been in a bear market now since, I guess, probably the second half of 2011, or going nearly 4 years or so of bear markets in gold. And you point out that one of the reasons is the dollar has been strong relative to other currencies, at least. And as you point out, the mainstream media is quick to say or try to justify this quote-unquote strong dollar on the basis of a stronger U.S. economy. But you have some other ideas, and I think you might have just touched on it a little bit momentarily there. But what are your ideas as to why the dollar has been relatively strong?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there's about $5 trillion of money in the monetary base. So those are real dollars that sit – the Federal Reserve is essentially issued. It's paper. And the banks take that $5 trillion – and they have created $57 trillion of loans as officially. And then if you look at the shadow banking system, which numbers aren't available, but that people estimated about another $20 trillion, and then foreign debt in dollars. In other words, a French company borrows dollars from a German bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not part of the U.S. dollar system, but there's still dollars out there that have to be paid back. So you add all that together, and you get to a number a little shy of $100 trillion. So you've got $5 trillion of actual currency, and you get $100 trillion of debt denominated in this currency, and that debt demands interest payments all day long. And so where does the money come from to pay that interest? And the answer is the Federal Reserve has to print it, and if they don't print it, you get a huge short squeeze. So ultimately, the dollar, I think, is going, I don't know if it's going to zero, but it's going a lot weaker, and the reason is because the assets in the Federal Reserve don't support it. But in the short term, what's happening is you're getting a huge short squeeze, and just like in the late 20s, in 1928, 1929, when the Fed started to get spooked about asset prices going too high, and they stopped printing so many dollars, and what happened was all the banks blew up because all of a sudden there weren't enough dollars for people to maintain their debts, and that's what caused the Great Depression. And what's interesting is you look at the shape of the increase in the monetary base in the 20s, and it looks exactly like it looks like in the 2000s. Bernanke takes over the Federal Reserve. Assets are going crazy, right? Oil went from whatever it was, $20 a barrel to $150.
Mm-hmm.
And real estate, you know, we all know about the subprime bubble, all those things. And the first thing he did was try to rein it in. We all think of Bernanke as the mad money printer. Of course, he is in a sense. But at first, he actually slowed down the printing of money. And shortly thereafter, with the banks enormously levered up, and of course derivatives make this much worse, the whole system blew up. And mm-hmm. so then they printed huge amounts of money to bail out the system, which they did. And now the bubble's much bigger. You know, Peter Walsh just had a book that came out to explain that the real estate situation is much worse now than it was in 2007. The BIS had a report saying there's twice as much debt now than there was in 2007. So all the conditions are much worse. You see the asset markets in a tremendous bubble. And so, of course, the Federal Reserve is worried about that, and they're trying to rein in the money printing. And the result will be exactly the same, which is as they stop printing the money, all of a sudden the shakiest lenders first will find that they don't have the dollars they need to pay back their debts. And so all of a sudden they won't be able to maintain their debts, and you'll start to see defaults. And I was interested. I saw today that there's an index for everything, I think, but there's one that tracks the rejection of credit application, and this thing has just fallen off a cliff. It's actually lower now than it was at the bottom of 2008. In other words, these are businesses that go into their banks and they say, hey, you know, I want to borrow money. The banks say no.
Huh.
That's flashing a huge warning sign. You have the, you know, I think the the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta has this new tool that's supposed to automate GDP estimates in real time. So you have to wait till a month after the quarter closes. Mm-hmm. And that thing's tracking. Well, it just ticked up from 0% to 0.1%. Meanwhile, the Fed in New York and Washington are saying, oh, well, no, we're actually growing at, I think, 2.5%. So, I mean, both Federal Reserves can't be right.
Oh.
Time will tell which, and it seems like the Atlanta one, which is a little more scientific on this metric, not that GDP matters, essentially GDP measures activity, doesn't measure wealth production, but be that as it may, it's not doing so well. And so I think that you're seeing very similar conditions to what we saw in 2008 and in 1929. And I think, Jay, it's very important to remember that it may well be that the banks naked short gold. It may well be that the Federal Reserve has a secret trading desk somewhere that you know, puts sell orders and makes gold go down. That's all very possible. But it's the definition of a credit bubble is an undervalued gold price, is other prices going up as against gold to an excessive degree. That is the definition of what a credit bubble is.
Mm-hmm.
So you should expect, one should expect that when one is living through the largest credit bubble that's ever been constructed by man, which we are, that gold will therefore be the lowest value it has ever been. And if you look at gold and all kinds of different monetary metrics like the monetary base, like the assets of the Federal Reserve, those sorts of things, gold is indeed now at an all-time historic low, and that's just what you'd expect. Of course, the flip side is that when the credit bubble pops, one should expect gold to have the largest transformation of any time in history, and that is really what I expect to happen when this bubble does, in fact, collapse.
Mm-hmm. So, that makes perfect sense, Dan. It really does, because as the bubble is expanding, everything else goes up in value relative to gold. But when it turns around, then gold goes up relative to everything else.
That's exactly right.
And in the short term, this is why, you know, a lot of gold bugs are amazed that we don't have runaway inflation by now. But I think you're pointing out the dynamics of the credit squeeze, or let's say the dollar short covering, in a sense, isn't it? When people have to sell what they're able to sell in order to meet the margin clerk's demands. If the Fed doesn't keep enough liquidity in this system, doesn't keep enough dollars printed for the system to continue on.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you know, I think the jury's still out on whether in this next crash, whether gold will take a big plunge at first, the mm-hmm. way 2007 and 2008, as people sold it to meet margin calls, or not. And the reason it might not is that I think back then there were a lot of levered longs in the gold markets. They had to sell to meet margin calls. Now there are a lot of levered shorts in the gold market, so they'll have to buy gold to make their margin calls. So I think it's not clear to me which way gold will lurch when the first crisis comes. But yes, that is my position, but one has to remember that is a going to be a very short-term phenomenon. In other words, when the big crunch comes, what will happen is either it'll be so big that the banks will just simply collapse very quickly and then gold will go through the stratosphere, or I think more likely Yellen and her merry band of pranksters will start printing money wholesale. Don't forget, Bernanke printed, what was it, about $4 trillion, $3 trillion over a number of years, but he guaranteed about $16 trillion in the first few months. Now the guarantees weren't triggered, but they were there. And so when the next bubble pops, when this bubble pops, Yellen's going to have to go guarantee. I mean, who knows how many trillions of dollars of assets? You know, $25-30 trillion numbers in that magnitude. And if those guarantees ever were to be triggered, in other words, if people show up and say, okay, Fed, you guaranteed my crappy assets, here they are, give me the money, then I think the world would be a very different place overnight, and gold would have a couple zeros added to its price.
I have no doubt about that. Dan, you know, just going back to the 2008-2009 event there, gold did take a hit to start with, but I also know that gold in real terms, as gold measured against a commodity basket, for example, went up very dramatically from about 2009 on till 2011, and the mining shares did very well also up through that period of time. So
Yes, that will happen again, of course. But, but in terms of strictly currency terms, what will affect gold's path in currency terms is who's holding it and what the dynamics are for those people when the crunch comes. And the problem with the real price of gold on the miners is not operational, as you point out. The gold goes up in terms of the cost of mining it when credit goes down. That is also true. But to the extent that companies have debt denominated in dollars, then they're also affected by what happens to the currency. And you know, the answer is again, I'm not convinced that gold takes a big hit this time, because again, I think many of the holders this time, unlike last time, are levered shorts, not levered longs, and so we can spike up.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, gold is at an all-time low in terms of the monetary system right now. So
yes, and that was not the case.
And that was not the case then. So who knows? Well, with a minute left yet, what is your outlook for the gold shares? I know that you're invested. Your fund invests in gold shares. Are we close to a bottom here?
Well, I think I approached that space in the terms of what we just discussed. I certainly have some holdings that have a lot of dollar debt on the theory that when the dollar collapses, that debt goes away and those companies get revalued a lot because they're valued so low right now because the market assumes they can't repay their debt.
Right.
As long as they have enough liquidity. Like if the debt's due in, say, 4 years, I don't really care about it because this will happen certainly within the next 4 years. So the market thinks they're going bankrupt and they won't go bankrupt. That's a huge transformation. You can have more safer positions where you buy companies without a lot of debt, and then you don't really care what gold does in terms of dollars. Then all you really care about is what gold does in terms of oil, and we all know what's happening with that. So I think that's how one should approach the mining sector in terms of your risk and allocating different amounts of capital to different possible outcomes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Dan. Let me just ask you, is there a way that our listeners can keep up with what you're doing at the CMRE and possibly attend that event from time to time?
Yeah, we have a website, cmre.org, and we'll have videos of the recent dinner up there in a couple of weeks. And we have a mailing list people can sign up for. They can join the organization. So it's all, we're all right there on our website.
Excellent. Very good. Well, thank you very much, Dan, for being with me again, and look forward to doing it again sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.